Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. I'm Adam Koch, Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim are my co-hosts and a very special guest today, Gavin Ryan, who will be talking all things Australian election, but of course we expect him to chip in throughout the podcast as well. Gav, welcome to Put Simply.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, what an interesting result in Canada, because if the election was held just a few months ago, the Conservatives were almost certain to be in office. But of course, there is one name that the Conservatives are blaming that the Liberals congratulating, and that is Donald Trump. Rodney, did the MAGA movement make Canada liberal again?
It seems to have. I haven't seen this, the final figures, obviously, yet to see whether they've got an overall majority. Maybe someone else has something more up to date. But it was looking as if it was moving in that direction. And and in fact, had it been 1 month ago, the Conservatives were ahead in the polls, and the good people of Canada, in a wave of rejection of populism following Trump's desire to make them the 51st state, have rejected anything to the right and said, we'll have the Liberals again. Mark Carney, boring, but you'll do us. And that's sort of how the election seems to have panned out. Trusted on the economics, the trade stuff that might be coming up. It's clearly good for the EU, because there's a ally in North America at a time when the US is clearly in some flux on defence and trade in Canada. And Carney is well-respected within Europe as well. So it may be a interesting switch of direction from the broader global shift to populism. The best part of it, of course, is that the opposition leader, who was on course a month ago to be prime minister, actually lost his own seat to someone called Fanjoy, even better. And Mr. Bruce Fanjoy, it's his first time being elected. And in the same, in that constituency or whatever, there was also a campaign to have the longest ever ballot sheet. I don't know if you're aware of this. And they managed to get 91 candidates on the ballot for the opposition leader's constituency. Mr. Fanjoy came out on top as the Liberal candidate, but there were candidates getting a series of candidates who got two votes, and clearly that was them and their partner or mother. And but there was one whose name escapes me for the time being who managed to get none. So well done him. Didn't even manage to vote for himself. 91 candidates, amazing. But yeah, it's clearly a solid move to the centre in terms of the Canadian election result.
Well, let's take a step back for a second, Ozan, because obviously Justin Trudeau resigned from being Prime Minister. He was deeply unpopular towards the end of his reign. The Liberal Party in Canada were looking to be completely wiped out by the Conservatives. What happened between when Trudeau said, "I'm done," and then Carney coming in, an untested politician, now coming to look like he will probably form a majority government in Canada?
Well, just 3 months ago, the Conservatives were almost 30 points up. I think it's unheard of for a political party to be so far ahead and lose so much ground in such a small period of time. And as Rodney alluded to, it's all about Donald Trump. And, you know, many of us, I'm sure, have Canadian friends or have been to Canada, etc. It's pretty difficult to upset Canadians. They're a great bunch of people, very difficult to get them angry and ready to fight. But Donald Trump has managed to do that. The Canadians have rallied around the flag. As soon as he came out with his 51st state comments, the number of actions that he took on trade, etc., he really got the Canadians to rally around their flag to protect their sovereignty and to protect their national kind of pride. And I think one of the important things to highlight here is that Carney, you mentioned, yes, is a bit of a boring politician. And if I would encourage anybody, if they've got time, to have a look at his acceptance speech, it is one of the most subdued election victory speeches I've ever seen in my life. But he's made a point of I think setting himself as a serious, a mature leader. He was unknown in the political realm, but very much trusted from the economic point of view, as he was the governor of the Bank of Canada and also served on the Bank of England board. So he was a direct contrast to everything that people, or he was in some ways a vehicle to kind of carry everyone's concerns, and they wanted a safe pair of hands and someone boring. And as we've said many times on this podcast, we are wishing and hoping for the days that politics is actually boring again. So they got their boring leader in some context, but he seems super capable, and I think he's going to unite the country, and I think it's a very good win for the Liberals. Looks like the other minor parties got almost wiped out. The NDP only managed to get 7 seats, but obviously they'll be very critical to help the Liberals reach a majority to govern.
It's also important to bear in mind that the Conservatives did increase their vote share and number of seats. So the loss of their leader, or their leader losing his seat, was somewhat of an aberration. And it was he personally was more associated with Trump and Trump rhetoric than you know, his broader party and candidate list. So he shouldered most of the impact of that himself.
Super interested in your views, Gavin, because we are seeing this, I guess, the partisan nature of how things are now starting to take shape, particularly in the West, right? And we're going to obviously have a look at the implications for the upcoming Australian election a little bit later. But what's your view on the fact that Canada was such a target for Trump? You know, he spoke about it being the 51st state of the United States. Obviously, the tariffs, the initial tariffs, impacted Canada the most. The population now seemed to have completely done a 180 and gone from literally one political party to another political party. Do you see this new movement, I guess, in the center left particularly, starting to have implications beyond just the Canadian borders?
Yes. I mean, well, this the what's happening in the US is affecting all of us, particularly in Australia, because we have a superannuation system where anyone of working age puts their money aside, and a majority of that goes into, you know, generally suggests stock market shares, those type of investments. And so people have seen in their hip pocket, effectively for their retirement savings, massive swings because of what's happening in the US. And I mean, what's the odds on a worldwide recession at the moment? I think it's about 60%. So it's not so much a center-left resurgency, almost as a pushback against the unprecedented events that are happening in the US. There was particularly, people were talking about the fact that there's been a lot of research on economic shocks that have occurred within the US, and then their broader implications. But all of those were external events, or events that were linked to, you know, you would say natural disasters, you know, disease. This one's been completely self-inflicted, and that's where people, we look particularly in politics at people's perceptions, and it's always been such that outside the US, Trump and his actions, and the actions kind of the new wave of Republicans under MAGA, have been soundly rejected, and there's outright hostility amongst a majority of people everywhere else on the globe. So that's where this has strengthened that, and in particular, Trump's rhetoric and then his actions, because before it was mostly rhetoric. Now it is concrete actions. And so as such, it's not so much a center-left revival as a rejection of anyone who has anything to do or has a history of kind of cozying up to those sentiments which Trump echoes. And that's what particularly in Canada happened, and dramatically so.
Yeah, and let's see how that would play out, I guess, in Australia in particular. And we'll get to that in a moment. But before that, I mean, it has been 100 days since Trump has taken office, and there have been a lot in the press you know, saying that he's done an incredible job in those first 100 days, and this is sort of the revolution starting in the US. There have been a lot in the press who've been saying, well, this is the end of the US democracy as we've come to know it. Ozan, when you have a look at back at the 100 days that we've never seen 100 days like this in US politics and arguably world politics, right? Can you, hand on heart, say, here's what Trump has done, which I commend him for, or here's what Trump has done, which is good and not bad?
I tried very hard to objectively look at it and see, what has he done that's good? And I think rather than talking about what has he done that's good or bad, I think let's look at outcomes, because at the end of the day, we get measured by the outcomes. Nothing or almost everything that Trump's done, he already said he was going to do. So at the end of the day, none of it is a surprise. And I would say some of the things that he talks about, and this goes back to what Gavin was saying, is that, you know, many people have lots of, issues, grievances that Trump capitalized on. And that's what populist leaders do. And what he's done in the last 100 days is he's put out a lot of press releases giving the impression that he's addressed those grievances and issues, and he's taken a lot of action. But as I said, from that point of view, compared to maybe President Biden, what he's done has been good because he's taken action. However, let's look at the outcomes, and there is no good news in the outcomes. Objectively speaking, the outcomes have been disastrous. You mentioned that it's been the most busiest and active 100 days of any president. You know what else is also historic? Approval ratings. He currently has the lowest approval rating of any prime minister, of any president in the last 80 years, according to a number of polling agencies. And guess who's number two? Trump 1.0. So he's beating himself for the top position, for the top position. We mentioned last week that the approval ratings were holding, but a number of approvals have come out, polls have come out, and his approval rating is absolutely tanking. And it's not just some of those organisations that he would dismiss as mainstream media, etc. Fox News has him basically at an approval rating of 44 and a disapproval rating of 55, so an 11 deficit. When you go to New York Times, Siena, they've got him on 42. CNN's got him on 43. Daily Mail's got him on 45. So it's now a trend is forming, and his popularity and his approval rating is absolutely tanking. And I mentioned it was a disaster for 100 days. Everything that he has done has turned out to not have any outcomes. And yes, it's early, but at the end of the day, it's had the opposite outcomes in some instances. He talked about DOGE, saving money, getting rid of fraud. Not one bit of fraud has been taken to court or identified. So it's just, again, another media release and just talking points. Not more than $100 billion, they're estimating it, and that's on the high side, has been saved in the federal budget. They were looking to save $2 billion, $3 billion. His immigration stuff, they've only been able to deport 130,000 people. They have a target of 1 million this year. And what's happening? They're rushing to deport a whole bunch of people. In fact, they're deporting citizens now, making a lot of mistakes because they're rushing around and not being able to do the proper due diligence that's required to implement these programs. Tariffs, Liberation Day has turned into an absolute mess. He has done not one trade deal since announcing Liberation Day. His relationship with China is terrible. He hasn't sorted out the Ukraine war that he was going to fix in 24 hours. In fact, that's going in the complete wrong direction. So a long list of outcomes that are completely disastrous. But yes, you can credit him with taking action. And in many people's views, that might be a very positive contrast to perhaps President Biden, who is perceived as not taking much action. But action is only one thing. You've got to look at outcomes.
Well, Ozan, that there has been, I mean, I thought about this long and hard as well. There has been one good outcome, one very strong plus, which is that it has shown that the limits that were perceived or written about or talked about for many generations in American politics actually in some places don't exist, which is that the conventions, the you would say the lines in the sand that many people had put around the executive branch actually, when tested, don't actually matter. And that's been impressive. And the other flip side to that coin has been that in showing what Trump is doing in his first 100 days, it has underlined the weakness of the Democrat response. I actually thought I was watching some sketch comedy when they were reading out a quote from Chuck Schumer, but the quote was real, that he had written a very strongly worded letter to the White House. Like that, if that's the top of your political game in the US, like that is, I think, what's the trade word? Ridiculous. You know, that's absolutely unbelievable. And so that it has shown that when the US kind of held itself as a example of exceptionalism around the way it's structured its government under a constitution, and particularly the different branches of government, in many cases that has dissolved and disappeared under the, you know, you would say the onslaught of a government hell-bent on just doing whatever. And on from that, the other thing about the first 100 days is that there is no political, you would say, tradecraft involved whatsoever. Like the things that they are doing are absolutely toxic in the extreme. The Doge work, the cuts, the unbelievable cuts they did to Veterans Affairs, the immigration work, the ICE agents kind of running rampant, the deportation of American citizens, particularly six-year-olds. I think it was a six-year-old with cancer, you know, an American child. These things are unbelievably toxic in mainstream politics and to a majority of voters, and in fact, an overwhelming majority of voters. So, you know, but again, it goes back to the fact that Trump had always been not great at politics, you know. And so that's where this isn't, you know, suddenly something new. It's always been there. But now that particularly in his second term, he resolved to do what he wanted with the generals that he wanted, with the people, the supporters that he wanted. And sometimes this is the unfortunate thing about someone who has not the skills to be able to hold it up. They do exactly this.
But, I mean, he effectively campaigned on and won on not being good at politics, didn't he? I mean, so much of what Trump's rhetoric has been anti sort of establishment, anti, you know, his words, not mine, but anti deep state. All of that stuff that he campaigned on is effectively the way that he's running the White House. And he did this before. He did it in his first term. It was a chaotic White House by all accounts, even by his own accounts. It was chaotic. And that chaos has sort of continued. I mean, Rodney, isn't it because he's bad at politics? Isn't it because he's not conventional in terms of how he runs stuff is why he's so popular?
That's right. He's very dismissive of the radical left lunatics, as he likes to call them. But, you know, his first 100 days in the first Trump presidency was characterized by the travel ban and the border wall and the travel ban again, also tested the courts and so on. I mean, this time there's a little bit more structure to it because he's got a longer list, which, you know, he's done very well on his Project 2025 advent calendar. He's opened a lot of those doors and had a lot of chocolates as a result of it. And he's done most of his work through executive order. So completely with Gavin that he set records on that front. But as much as the immigration stuff is popular, or is popular with his base, attacking elite education again is popular. Cutting foreign aid is popular, and there's an American indifference potentially to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, but certainly the pro-Israel position has a level of popularity within America as well. Where it started to swing against Trump is around trust on the economic stuff as a result of tariffs, and where you've got people who've been made redundant in terms of the civil service and DOGE cuts, which are biting on real people in America in numbers. It means it gets known much wider than the individuals who are directly affected by it, unlike the immigration and so on points, and that in a way has been responsible for his dip. And you know, that's just a misunderstanding of the impact of your policies on your own voters. So yeah, in that sense, he is anti-political or not political, but yeah, it's not where he wants to be, given his obsession with his own popularity and so on. And yeah, I mean, he is an anti-politician, but he still has to acknowledge that what he's managed over his first 100 days is a lot of activity and not the right outcome in terms of what he wanted, which is his own standing to be the best ever. Although I think he announced that at a recent rally, that it is the case. The economy is the best ever. The shape of defence is the best ever. America's reputation in the world, certainly the best ever. Immigration's the best ever. The White House lawn has more pictures on it than ever before, which is weird mugshots of people who have been deported. And the judiciary are the most compliant ever, we probably want to say. So that too, best ever. So well, yeah.
The other thing, Rodney, though, it will be put in stark contrast very quickly, is that this is about to get like extremely bad and worse in terms of the effectively the policies that he campaigned on, and those simple promises, which are tremendously effective when you use them in campaigns, which is day one, I'm going to decrease prices. The prices of your groceries are going to go down. And what's happened? It's gone the other way. Now, with the work that they've done with China, and particularly the, you know, the trade and tariff war that they created, there's massive uncertainty, and no one is being able to order because they just don't know the tariff regime for China. So, hence, all the orders from China, the stock, the inventory, and others, it is going to be sitting either on the docks or sitting still in China. So, give it 2 to 3 weeks. And you may see empty shelves in the US, which is diabolical for any politician ever. Yeah. Like it will lead to he already has record disapproval ratings. He will be the best ever at his disapproval ratings.
But those are the ideological components of 2020 Project 2025 that he's pursuing, which are detached from what the on the ground impact is. You know, they're nearly purist policies in terms of dramatically reshaping America's relationship with the world economically, you know, stripping out the civil service and so on to save money. Those particular policies are very distinct from the ones around immigration, attacking the, you know, the left on trans issues or woke issues or whatever they want to describe it, what they do in foreign policy, foreign aid and so on, because it affects those people over there. But these are the ones that affect us. They're being pursued as for ideological reasons, and that's where the impact's going to bite. I agree entirely. His popularity is likely to not improve, and any change is going to be away from where he wants it to be.
Well, let's have a look at the Trump effect then on the another Commonwealth country, and that's of course Australia, that's heading to the polls this Saturday. Gavin, set the scene for us. Is it Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's election to lose, or is that oversimplifying where things are likely to land?
Well, as someone who, you know, you should always make things, you know, simple, as we're on the Put Simply podcast. But in terms of the way it is currently, it stands currently in terms of the polling and support, it would seem that it is Anthony Albanese's election to lose, because the trend has been consistent, and it has largely mirrored what has happened in Canada. Now, not that it may be in the same quantum, but in terms of when it changed, it was in the same timing, which is that it coincided with the dramatic kind of events out of the US around tariffs and trade and kind of Trump's rhetoric, and then all the other actions, because we do get a fairly steady stream of US news here, and that's basically that, you know, we get great images, we get great research, we get a lot of those news stories come through, and that's combined with the conservatives here having an increasing far right presence in terms of the far right of the party, particularly in the Liberal National Conservatives, has grown, and they've been more bold in terms of the statements they make and the kind of public support of Trump and Trump-like policies. So what happened was that the trend, in terms of the trend back to the Labor Party federally, effectively started when Trump undertook all these actions. And before that, the Conservatives had been sitting pretty. And in fact, they set up their campaign messaging around a lot of, like you would say, shadows or echoes or the same themes as Trump had used very effectively in the US. So yes, I would say simply, it is Anthony Albanese's to lose. And I should add, just before we, you know, talking about, we talked about Canadian elections earlier, and given Bruce is such a great, you know, Australian name, and if anyone remembers the classic sketch of all the Bruces, you know, by Monty Python, I'd noticed that this seat, the Canadian Conservative leader who lost his seat, he lost it to Bruce Fanjoy, you know, which, so I think there's a tie in there, very, might be slightly tenuous, but, you know, that's where, you know, Bruce is a very strong name. And Bruce, the seat in terms of Victoria, the federal seat of Bruce, is one of the swing seats, which will be very interesting to watch.
Last election, Gav, produced a plethora of independents. We've been seeing that on the rise in Australia in terms of people swinging away from the major parties and bringing independents into parliament, which of course has then meant that, you know, under the last minority government, which is going back a fair bit now under the previous Labor Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, it meant that she had to do quite a bit of deals with the independents to get across. Are we likely to see the potential of a minority government coming in, or just independents increasing but Labor sort of, you know, maintaining its majority? What role are they likely to play in this federal election?
Very big role. To set the scene for people who are not as familiar with the, you know, kind of the minutiae of the Australian results, was that increasingly over time, the major parties have been getting less of a share of the total vote. And so it's been very marked since about, you know, the early 1980s, and it's been progressively dropping over time. And that's been filled by independents and minor parties. So that has meant that with on the left, the Greens were the first to take advantage of this, taking away, you would say, traditional Labor Party seats in urban areas, mostly in the larger cities. And those then, you know, have never come back. So the Labor Party was put at a disadvantage in terms of they had lost lower house seats to Greens. Then that was, you know, from about, you know, the early 2000s onwards. What happened was that then ultimately it's happened now to the Conservatives. So the Teal movement, they're kind of broadly classed as Teals. It's a label applied to them, but a whole range of independents that were formed through a movement to get independents into parliament, they were very successful in the last election because their messaging really worked against a lot of sitting Liberals, again, in those urban seats in larger cities. So traditional seats, well, when I say traditional seats, traditional Conservative seats, so long-held Conservative seats that in most cases had never been held by anyone else than the Conservative parties, particularly the Liberal Party in Sydney and in Melbourne. And so they lost a number of their crown jewels, you would suggest. And they do not look like coming back, because the other part about this movement was that they were tremendously organised. Some of the most effective political campaigning I've seen, and I live on the border of one of their electorates, so Josh Frydenberg, who was the member for Kooyong, had been the treasurer of Australia in the last government. He had thousands of volunteers. He had hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, the most advertising you can possibly get. And yet he failed to understand that what had worked against him was that by advertising and by being so out there, that had worked against the messaging of the grassroots work that was being done against him. So Monique Ryan, who's the independent member there, she looks to be still be going strong. And for the most part, a lot of those independent Teal members that took seats off the Liberals. They did not look like those seats will come back to the Liberal National Party. So the Liberal National Party were had to make up a lot of ground. They had to win over 20 seats to get back into majority government, which meant that they had to take seats from the Teals and also seats back from the Labor Party. Now, they looked very good against the Labor Party in terms of their messaging. They had, fairly simple cost of living messaging, and they talked about getting Australia back on track, which is a kind of a rehashing of the kind of Make America Great Again theme, and they were doing very well. However, they also put some lead in their saddlebags in terms of sticking to or holding on to policy ideas and then going full hell for leather on policy that was unpopular, to say the least. So the one that immediately springs to mind is a nuclear policy in terms of creating a whole set of nuclear reactors, which in Australia, nuclear power and nuclear energy has a long history of being deeply opposed. And so that has kind of weighed against them. But as soon as the Trump, effectively the Trump, you would say the move set in against them, they were in trouble. But the other part is that the independents are still going strong. So the polling for a lot of those independent members of parliament is still very strong. So it looks like there will be still that large presence in parliament of independent members. And the Albanese government only just got a majority last time. And that was that they achieved a couple of results which weren't expected. So the seat of Higgins here in Melbourne, they won for the first time ever. A much kind of heralded result within the party, but hasn't really been largely recognised. Now, that seat has been abolished and has now resulted in a new seat in WA, which most likely will go to the ALP. But in terms of the presence in Parliament of independents, the Albanese government just got over the line last time. It will be touch and go. And in my heart of hearts, I don't think that they will actually achieve a majority, because there are some very challenging circumstances, particularly in New South Wales, where there are some seats where renewable energy is an issue, particularly for some of the offshore wind farms. There've been the Liberal National Coalition have been successful in kind of, you'd say, wedging the Labor Party on some of those renewable energy issues, and particularly around coal mining communities. So it only takes the loss of a couple of seats and the Albanese government will be effectively no longer. It will just be that they are the party in the parliament with the most seats, but they won't have a majority, and then they'll have to start negotiations.
I was just going to ask Gavin, what have been some of the big issues? You touched on a few of them, but what are the kind of top three issues that are on people's minds as they go to the polls on Saturday?
Well, the biggest issue has been, like, almost that covers almost all other issues, has been cost of living. So cost of living, because it covers so many, it's the be all and end all of your existence in terms of as you're trying to get by. And that's covered the housing issues in terms of the supply of housing, the cost of housing for those who are either own it or for those who are trying to rent. Rentals have been, diabolical in terms of rent rises and availability across Australia, because of the fact that interest rates went up. And as such, we have a large percentage of people who own houses that are basically geared for their investment incomes. And they tried to recoup the losses that they were getting from paying increased interest rates. And that meant that renters then faced that pain as a result, like a flow on. Now, the other part is that there's not a great deal of supply coming through with housing. So you're seeing a real crunch in terms of the availability of housing in the large urban centres. Even in places like Tasmania, there's acute shortages. And then on top of that, there's been, within the campaign, there's been these, you'd say, almost dedicated issues around energy. Energy has been a big one, the energy mix, just because particularly gas, we export a lot of gas at extremely cheap, whereas within Australia we are paying premium prices from the same producers. Now, that was set in place under the Howard government many years ago. And so there's that's seen as a great injustice. However, overlaying that is, you know, the push to a different energy mix in terms of we have a lot of aging coal-fired power infrastructure, and that is enormously costly. And so that, and involves that they involve a lot of jobs. So to deal with that, Liberal National Party came up with a bold, I would suggest, move to come up with small to medium nuclear reactors for power generation. So now, would that happen? Probably not, because they take so long to build and they're expensively and costly. But in terms of a short takeaway, they thought that it would be able to give them the advantage in places like some of the New South Wales seats and Victorian seats, where you have these communities of workers that effectively work within coal-fired power. And then on top of that, you've got some of the, you would say, the state-to-state issues kind of that have come up, which is that in Victoria, for example, the Allan Labor government is proving to be, it's come up internally in polling from both parties, is proving to be unpopular in some areas of the state. So they're using that particularly in their advertising. And then you've got New South Wales, like I mentioned before, there are effectively some regional issues that, and this works obviously in federal parliament because you're trying to win on a seat by seat basis. So when it's this tight, and it particularly is tight because ultimately, even though the polling is generally reliable, and you know the parties do tracking polling and quite good tracking polling, it can be that a lot of people are undecided, or when you're polling them, they suggest that their vote is with either a minor party, in effect parking their vote for the purposes of not wanting to tell you that they're undecided. So there's always that level of uncertainty. The other thing that feeds into this is that record numbers of people are voting early. So I think it's up to about 4 million that have voted early in pre-poll. Now, there's still 3 days to go, I think, before election day. And so that polling, you're getting a strong percentage of people who have already voted. So in fact, the polling numbers and the support that's out there, if you know, if it's to be in effect translated, then it's real, it's exact, that advantage for the Albanese Labor government has already been baked in for a large number of voters. So that's the other factor, is that there's no traditional election day as such anymore. Because of the early polling, it happens that people vote in massive numbers. And that's not just through early polling centres, pre-poll, it's through postal voting as well.
Let's get a prediction from you, Gav. Are you personally thinking a majority Labor government? And if so, what would the majority look like?
Well, it's just no, I'm not expecting a majority Labor government.
You're not? Okay.
And I'm expecting that will lead to some very interesting negotiations on the other side of the election. And the reason I say that is because the Labor Party vote is holding up in WA. It was a great, epic result there previously. It's holding up in WA. It's holding up in South Australia. Victoria is interesting. It might be there might be a 2-for-2 or 3-for-3 in terms of the Labor Party lose 3 seats to the Liberal Nationals and then gain some seats in other places. So the mix might change, but the overall result will roughly stay the same. New South Wales will be critical. So New South Wales, the ALP, the Labor Party, may lose a couple of seats to the Liberal Nationals, and Queensland looks roughly the same. Now, Tassie doesn't have a great amount of seats, but they can be pivotal. But again, it's not a huge number of seats. So in the way that it comes down, my hit prediction is that effectively the Labor Party will go down a couple of seats, which will put them into a just minority, and then the Conservatives will roughly remain on their kind of 50-something seats, and with a large number of Greens and Independents in the parliament. And then the real challenge is, who do you go to? Now, the Gillard government went to the two Independents in New South Wales, so they went to two. Now, they weren't classically kind of progressive Independents. Plus, the other thing was there was a written deal with the Greens. But what that turned into was that it was not seen to be very popular, and it was perceived negatively. So, you know, do you do a deal with the Greens? Probably not. They would aim to get some kind of deal with some independents, but none of those deals, I think, would touch it with a barge pole. So it makes for great viewing. Now, not as great viewing as the US, you know, season two, but, you know, this will be very interesting to watch.
I don't think anything compares to the US anywhere in the world at the moment. But thank you, Gav. Appreciate that that insight and that analysis on what is likely to happen this Saturday in polling in Australia. Of course, another poll is taking place on Saturday, and that is in Singapore. Rodney, you live in Singapore. Explain how elections there work and what the likely outcome of Saturday's poll is.
So the PAP is the ruling party, which is centre-right and has been in the ruling party since the foundation of Singapore. They've changed leader for this election, or prior to the election, with PM Lee standing down and Lawrence Wong taking over as prime minister. So it's his first big electoral test for a mandate, and he's changed, I think, somewhere in the region of one third of the candidates. So some big hitters from the previous governments have gone. PAP's been recognised as the founders of the wonderful Singapore story, good governance, long-term strategic thinking, and economic success. But in the last couple of elections, the Workers' Party, which is the main opposition party, has increased its number of seats, I think from 6 in 2015 to 10. In 2020, which is their best performance. There is 95 seats at the last election, 97 available at this election. And there's another opposition party called the Progress Singapore Party, which has two seats in parliament, but those are seats given to the best performing unsuccessful candidates, which is a device historically to create a space for opposition within parliament, given the success of the PAP. The PAP are, of course, likely to win again. I think the Workers' Party are fielding 26 candidates. So the outcome of the election in terms of who forms the next government should be fairly straightforward. There are 11 opposition parties. There is no polling because it's regulated during elections in Singapore. But there is incredibly active campaigning, both online and street campaigning. You have a lot of activity. There's political rallies. There are street loud hailer type campaigning in residential areas. And Singaporeans are very engaged. So it's quite a dynamic election, although the PAP has been in power, you know, for the history of the country. And I guess the great test for Lawrence Wong will be how the opposition Workers' Party perform. There are 11 opposition parties at this election. So, yeah, there's a lot of activity. I think there's probably 5 seats already in effect decided, because there haven't been no opposition parties fielded candidates in those against PAP candidates. So it's the remaining 92 which are there to be contested. So it's certainly a dynamic and exciting election within Singapore, and the electoral test for the new prime minister, who, of course, is only the fourth prime minister since the foundation of the country.
So less about who wins, but more so about how much in Singapore then. Ozan, before we go, let's get a prediction from you, particularly for Australia, for polling day, which is more likely to be a very, very contested one. And any thoughts on Singapore before we sign off?
Yeah. Well, I think I have to agree with my girlfriend, Gavin, that it's going to be a very close election, despite what the polls are saying in Australia in terms of a trend, you know, a positive trend towards the Labor Party. I think it's worth highlighting. It's, you know, if the Labor Party lose net a couple of seats, obviously they're still very close to having a majority government. You know, it doesn't, they still hold many more seats than the coalition would. Of course, depending on what happens with the independents. But I think it'll be a very close election in the sense that, you know, the Labor Party, I think, you know, may definitely end up in a minority government situation. On Singapore, I think, as you said, there's never really, a question around, you know, the PAP's dominance in Singapore politics. But of course, the question is how many seats will be as the main opposition party, Workers' Party, will pick up. And look, at this point, it's a little bit hard to tell because they also have to hold on to the 10 seats they have. There's 93 seats in the parliament. It might be worthwhile putting simply here how the parliament is elected. It's elected through two types of elections as such. So you have 17 of those, the 33 areas or constituencies, 17 of them are multi-member area electorates. So that means basically that each party puts up five or six candidates. And whoever gets the most votes, whichever party gets the most votes, automatically elect those five. And then there's 15 what they call single member electorates. So that's probably a bit more what our listeners would be used to. That is one electorate or one constituency where you know, whoever gets the most votes, whichever individual member gets the most votes, wins. So it, as Rodney said, the Workers' Party need to protect all of their multi-member electorates that they have, and I think they've got one single-member electorate. I think a similar makeup. That would be my prediction to what we had in the 14th, the last parliament, 14th parliament.
Well, Jens, thank you so much for another week of putting things as simply as possible, and thank you, Gavin Ryan, for being our special guest this week. See you next time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroku Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.